Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. This week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be speaking with Mark Ventola. He is with the law firm of Sheehan Finney Bass & Green in Boston, Massachusetts. He's going to be talking about the critical area of wage and hours, and he's going to be updating us, and this is a great topic for all employers. Mark, I appreciate you being on the show today. Hey, you know, we're going to be talking about a topic that is critical to employers, and that's wage and hour. And you're going to provide an update and a must know on this topic. So I guess I know why it's so important. Can you explain to HR professionals, business people out there that may be either new or just starting a company, why this is so critical for them?
Sure. There's a few reasons, but the primary reason that it is so critically important today is that employees have become much more aware of their rights in a whole host of areas, but particularly in wage and hour. And the stakes for a company, for an employer, if you get it wrong, are extraordinarily high. If you get it wrong, you have a clean heart, good heart, you're trying to do it right. But if you get it wrong on a technicality, you're responsible for three times the damages and legal fees of the attorney who's hired by the employee to come after you. So there's a lot at stake. And if you have many employees that you might make a little mistake for, you're potentially responsible for a class or collective action. So the numbers can add up very quickly for any employer. It can become a situation where it's the type of case or claim that puts the foundation of the company at risk, really. And that's why, from my perspective, it's so important, just from a civil law perspective, from the perspective of dealing with employees in your workforce.
Well, you know, I have said and I continue to say that most employers want to do the right thing. 99.9% of the employers want to pay people properly. They want to, you know, just follow the law. They just want to make widgets, whatever it is they do. And, you know, all these things that are important, sometimes they get a headache, but, you know, but they want to do the right thing, right? I mean, that's what they want to do. And paying people is critical to making that as, it's like the fundamental foundation of work.
Yeah. And that's exactly how I describe this area of law is, getting it right is like building the foundation of a house. If you don't have the pay practices in your organization set up in a way that you're paying people correctly, the foundation can quickly crumble and your house can fall apart. And as we get into this, I can give you a few really simple examples of how that might be the case. But you're exactly right.
And that's examples will be critical to really understanding and having people understand that. So let's start with some basics. Let's go over the basics. We can get into examples as we move our way through. So let's define for the audience right up front what you mean by wage and hour law.
Sure. There are two basic areas where wage and hour law comes from. Wage and hour law is essentially the series of laws that define how it is that employers must pay their employees. And you look to two sources for that, the federal government and the particular state or states within which you're working. The federal government has an act called the Fair Labor Standards Act. It's been around since the Great Depression. And what it defines for employers is how you pay people, when you are required to pay people overtime, who you must pay by the hour, who you can pay a salary for, in simple terms. And once you, most employers know, once for your hourly employees, your what are called your non-exempt employees, once they work more than 40 hours in a week, you have to pay them time and a half. So you look to the federal law, you also look to your state laws. And I'm going to give you a quick example there. State law can do more, can require more than federal law, but you can never, as a matter of state law, set a lower floor than federal law. So simple example is in the state of Massachusetts, where I do most of my work, the minimum wage is $8 an hour. From a federal perspective, it's $7.25 an hour. So no state can set their minimum wage at less than $7.25, but any state could set it at more, like Massachusetts has chosen to do. And so that's an area where, and what you would talk about when you say wage and hour law, just a very quick and brief description of it.
Sure. And again, just continue with the definitions. You talked about hourly versus salary. And I know that it, certainly in the last year, there's been some Supreme Court decisions that helped define supervisors and so forth out there.
Yeah.
But at the bottom line, give a very short definition of the difference between the two.
Yes. Hourly and salary are what I would describe as the non-technical terms. Most people, many employers, think of it that way. What we're really talking about, though, from a wage and hour law perspective, is the employees who are exempt from overtime, meaning you do not have to pay them extra for overtime. Those would be your salaried people. And the non-exempt folks are your hourly folks, people who are working on a basis where they are paid for every hour they work. For those folks, you have to pay them time and a half for every hour over 40. Now, when you get into it, a lot of employers believe, mistakenly, that they can simply decide themselves who they want to make exempt and who they want to make non-exempt. And they will sometimes, for administrative convenience or ease, make a large percentage of their workforce exempt or salary, just because it's, I think we can all see, it's easier to administer. You think, we'll pay you a set salary every week. I don't have to worry about tracking your hours. I don't have to worry about paying you overtime. And that salary is my own personal and our personal estimate of how much you work in a week. Very, very risky proposition. Very risky thing to do. So
when an employer is trying to make these decisions, because, you know, practically to help them, what are some of the, where can they go to find, you know, that answer? Because, you know, they may think to themselves, well, I'm pretty sure I'm doing it right. And there's got to be a definition somewhere.
They can go to a few places. Of course, if you have a good employment lawyer, that's the first place to go. If that's not something you have the ability to do or you have the opportunity to consult with, you can go to the Department of Labor's website. The United States Department of Labor has a very good website, and it provides a lot of information for employers. It provides the information you need to make the decisions about who should be exempt and non-exempt. In many cases, though, it's a close call, and just to throw out a few examples, in order to be exempt, someone has to be, you have to be able to classify them as fitting into essentially one of five categories. They have to be an executive, they have to be an outside salesman, they have to be a professional, a learned professional like a doctor, lawyer, accountant, architect, engineer. They have to be an administrative employee, or they have to be someone who works heavily in computer analysis. So if they fit within one of those categories, and each one has its own definition, you might be able to classify them as exempt if you meet a few other tests.
So there are other categories, and while we're just trying to get out the definitions out here, people might say, well, I hire independent contractors. I pay per diem. I pay other ways to people that work for me. Do they fall under the wage and hour, or is that separate?
All of that. Everyone that you just described potentially falls under the wage and hour laws. When you say I hire independent contractors, what you're saying really as an employer is these folks are not my employees. They're doing a set job and I'm paying them for that job, and I'm not going to withhold taxes. I'm not going to pay into the unemployment fund. I'm not going to pay into Social Security. Again, that is a situation that these days is very risky. The government really all state and federal government have targeted the for examination, independent contractor classifications. So if you decide to classify someone as an independent contractor, you better make sure that you're entitled to do that as a matter of law. Because if you're not entitled to do that, you run a real risk of being investigated by a whole host of government agencies to see if it's a proper classification.
No, and I think that's important, right? Because people need to understand there is a difference, and there are real strict rules that apply to these positions that could be. The other thing I'm just going to throw out there as we round out this little segment, interns. A lot of questions have come up, a wage and hour on interns. Some are paid, some are unpaid. Definitions between the two.
Yeah. The intern question is a really good one, especially right now. There's been quite a bit of litigation, and there's a few industries in which the intern question has been the subject of both government investigation and litigation. The broadcast industry, television, a number of radio and TV shows recently, because radio and television shows are a big source of hiring interns, and I'm sure you're familiar with that. So unless you're entitled to have someone as an intern and not pay them, you should be paying them for all the time that they work. And it's a really simple 6-point test I can run through very quickly.
Go ahead. That would be great information.
Yeah, because, again, this is a very hot topic right now. And in order to have an intern, a true intern, and not pay them, you have to make sure that, one, the intern is getting some kind of training similar to that they would receive in an educational environment. Second, there has to be some experience that the intern is receiving for their own benefit. Third, that intern cannot displace a regular employee in your workplace. The employer has to be in a situation where they're not deriving any immediate advantage from the intern, and in fact, the intern may at times impede the operations of the employer. And the way I use a good example to describe this when I'm talking to folks, which is, last summer I was painting the basement of my house. My wife calls down and says, "How long is that going to take?" And I said, "About 2 hours." And she says, "Well, I'll send your son down to help you." I said, "Well, then it'll take 3 hours."
Exactly.
So it may impede operations to do that. And then last, there has to be an agreement between the employer and the intern that there's no wages will be paid. So if you meet all of those requirements, you can take on an intern and not pay them for the time. If you ever have a question or if you think it's in doubt, the best practice is just take them on and pay a minimum wage. Minimum wage is still relatively low, and you won't run the risk as an employer.
So the last part of this question is, and this happens for employers out there, there are ways you can pay people under the minimum wage, either a training wage or a development wage or different things. And certainly we understand waitresses and that whole area of the law.
Yes.
So could you define that a little bit? And I think this is really a good starting point for our next segment where we get into all that sections about it.
Sure. There are some examples and some situations where you can pay sub-minimum wage. You mentioned, David, one of the primary examples, those being folks that are so-called tipped employees, folks that work in a restaurant setting or a bar, perhaps, that type of a setting, where they receive a significant portion of their income through tips. And when that's the case, the employer is entitled. Every state amount is a little different, but it's around $2. In Massachusetts, it's $2.63 an hour that the employer would be allowed to pay, provided that the tips make up the difference between the sub-minimum wage and the actual minimum wage. So at the end of a week or a work period, if it's 2 weeks, the employer has to figure out if, when you add up all the tips and the sub-minimum wage that's paid, the employee is receiving at least the minimum wage. If the employee is not receiving the minimum wage in that setting, then the employer needs to make up the difference. So, I mean, that's really the chief example of it. And you see the restaurant industry right now And the tipped employee industry right now, in general, is an area where, again, there is lots and lots of litigation about tips and about who's entitled to get them and share in them. And I think most people who are in the HR industry know that Starbucks has been a target and recently paid an enormous settlement to deal with that type of thing. Dunkin' Donuts has been a target. It's gotten to the point there where many of the Dunkin' Donuts, you'll walk in and you'll see a little sign that says no tipping allowed. And there's perhaps a little jar where folks can put their change towards the benefit of some charity. And that's really what the driver is behind that.
We're talking with Mark Ventola. He is a employment attorney with Sheehan Finney Bass and Green. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, and we will be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Because you've booked with Booking.com, you, freedom lover, are on the road and carefree. You're not worried that dealership billboards spoil beautiful views or that the fresh, cool breeze gives you a mouthful of fumes. No, because you know in just a few more miles, you'll be free to rock around in the perfect Booking hotel, treehouse, or rustic cottage of your dreams. Thanks to Planet Earth's number one accommodation site, Booking.com. Booking.yeah!
You might hear some advice from your friends on choosing a health plan.
Darling, you must choose the gold healthcare plan.
Not the silver plan. Too much trouble. Do they have a stainless steel plan?
I like bronze, like my tan.
Are sunburns covered? Instead, take advice from a licensed agent from Northern Insurance Group.
Meet face-to-face with a local healthcare exchange professional. Call Northern Insurance Group today. We have the resources to make sure you make the right choice.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with Mark Ventola. He is an employment attorney with Sheehan Finney Bass and Green. And we're talking about the exciting, and yes, I do mean exciting, topic of wage and hours, because everybody likes to be paid for working, don't they, Mark?
They do. They
and
do.
They get really upset when they don't get paid. I don't understand why, but they do.
The only ones who don't seem to be upset are the lawyers who are representing.
Well, that's another whole topic. And boy, we could get into wage and hour discussion on that if you'd like. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. All right. So, you know, we talked about it before in the first segment. We really did a great job of defining a lot of the different areas in terms of the where wage and hour really matter in terms of the categories. So let's talk a little bit about some of the rules and the regulations that go along with this, what some exceptions might be out there. Take me through maybe an example or a story of how somebody can get in themselves in trouble or shouldn't get themselves in trouble. So let's start down that area. So talk a little bit about some of the things that are important to remember in this area.
Sure. I think it's important to remember from a compliance perspective that as an employer, you should always start with the assumption that you need to pay someone, as an hourly or non-exempt employee. That's really the starting point. And if you're thinking that you will pay someone differently, you'd make them non-exempt and pay them a salary, you have to ask yourself, am I entitled to do that and why? and really run through the analysis. Don't make assumptions based on a job title or how things have been done for the last 20 or 30 years without question. Start with that assumption that people must be paid by the hour and receive time and a half for any time they work beyond 40 hours in a work week. And then work through the analysis before you decide that you're going to pay this person on a salaried basis. That's one. Two, if you make that decision and you're going to pay someone on a salary basis, make sure that you follow the rules there. The person has to make at least $455 a week, which generally in the Northeast is not a problem. But the salary has to be a minimum of $455 a week, which equates to about $23,500 a year. Okay. The second thing you have to remember is if someone is paid on a salary, to be truly paid on a salary, they have to receive that salary amount every week, regardless of the quality or quantity of the work they perform. So you can't dock a salary for someone who decides they're leaving early on a particular day, or they need to make a doctor's or a dentist appointment, or they have to go to school with their children. You generally speaking, cannot dock someone's pay if they're receiving a salary. If you decide to do that, you're running a real risk that you would blow the exemption, and you potentially would have to go back and figure out how much they are owed on an hourly basis. So those couple of things to keep in mind are very important if you're going to make a decision at the very beginning to pay someone on other than an hourly basis.
So if you can't dock them for their time, all right, I can just hear employers listening, saying to themselves, but they didn't work 40 hours this week. They didn't do the time I expected them to do. What can they do?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. One is you have to understand that the trade-off that's being made here at base, which is if you're going to pay someone on a salary, what you're saying is I'm going to pay this person the same amount every week, whether they're working 30 hours or 60 hours for me. So that you, while yes, if someone works less than 40 hours in a week, you'll be paying them that same salary, but you'll be paying them the same salary if they work quite a bit more than 40. And the trade-off, that's obviously the trade-off. If you want to get pay for exactly the amount of work hours that someone works, you pay them on an hourly basis and you pay them for all the hours they work, and you pay them overtime. There are a couple of reasons, however, there are seven of them to be exact, when you could pay someone a salary, make them exempt, and still dock their pay. I always counsel to be very careful about this. It's really the exception, it's not the rule, but there are seven reasons why you could dock someone's pay. And I'm glad to run through
them. Yeah, no, I think this would be very important, yes.
Sure. One of the reasons is you could dock someone pay if you have disciplined them and suspended them for a full day or more. You could dock their pay for that if they've committed some serious breach of discipline. You can dock someone's pay for an absence of one or more days, full days, not half days, but full days, for personal reasons that are not related to sickness or disability. So that's one. Another is that you could dock someone's pay, again, for full days, not half days, if the deductions are made under a plan or policy in place, that you have a plan or policy in place providing for wage replacement for those days. So if you have and you're offering sick days, but perhaps the person has run out of sick days, you could dock. For that reason. You can also, if you choose to do so, reduce someone's pay as an offset for perhaps jury duty fees that they receive. If they're out on jury duty for a day during the work week, so they've missed a day of work, you're still paying them the salary, but say they received $50 in jury duty fees, you could reduce their pay by that amount. You can also, reduce someone's pay if they violated, dock someone's pay if they violated a safety rule that is of major significance. So if you have someone on salary, for example, and then maybe perhaps they work in a manufacturing facility, they violate some major safety rule that's in place for good reason, you can dock pay. You can also dock or reduce pay for someone who's out on FMLA leave. Generally speaking, family and medical leave time is unpaid, so you wouldn't have to pay someone during that period of time. The other reason is if the first week or the last week of someone's work is less than a full week, you don't have to pay them for the full week salary for that week. So those are the reasons why. If you don't fall within one of those reasons, you shouldn't be docking someone's pay if they're salaried.
No, I think that gives a great overview. So a couple of questions that come up. One, and I know this question came up in regards to the new Affordable Care Act, whereas in the Affordable Care Act, it talks about 30 hours being full-time. Does this change the definition of 40 hours for salary, or is this going to be an issue that is still not decided yet?
That will not change the 40-hour work week for purposes of salary. The 40 hours in the Fair Labor Standards Act and the 30 hours in the healthcare law really have no relationship to one another. And I don't see that 40-hour work week changing. I haven't heard any mention of it as part of legislation. And it seems to me that that rule has been established and is so well settled that it will not be changing.
Okay. One of the
things I wanted to mention on that point is, as I said at the beginning, the Fair Labor Standards Act was a Depression era law. One of the reasons why the 40-hour work week was created was and the overtime was at time and a half for hours over 40 was put in place was to try to incentivize employers to hire more people. Provided this incentive for working, allowing people to work beyond 40, provide an incentive for employers to bring on the next employee.
Right. No, that makes perfect sense. The second question comes up is that some employers say, yes, you have to work 40 hours, but actually we have a policy here where salary is 50 hours. Is that legal?
I have never heard of that, and I'd be interested in hearing just a little bit more. Salary is 50 hours.
In other words, we require a 50-hour work week, and you'll be paid salary for it.
Sure. If the employee in question is, and the position the employee holds, is truly entitled to be classified as exempt and thus paid a salary, an employer can set the expectation of work hours being whatever they like. If it's the kind of position that's going to demand 50 hours in a week, that can be expected. That expectation level can be set. Because the employee has to work however many hours are required to perform the job. As long as they're entitled to be classified as exempt, the employer can certainly set that kind of an expectation.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour, talking with Mark Ventola. He is an employment attorney at Shee, Finney, Bass, and Green. And we will be right back. Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
On to round three. If a train leaves Spokane...
Schenectady by Saturday.
Correct. March comes before May. What's in my left pocket?
Half a mint and a rusty switchblade.
Correct.
Bam.
Who lets you watch TV episodes and movies instantly over the internet?
Ha-ha! Netflix!
Correct! Watch unlimited TV episodes and movies for only $8 a month from Netflix. See terms of use.
That is rad!
I know. Can you put me down now?
Sorry.
I'm a hugger.
I want to introduce you today to a new HR Power Hour sponsor. It's the AARP. They, of course, are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization with a membership of, yes, more than 37 million people. Here in Maine, there are over 230,000 members, and their office is located right here in Portland, Maine. Their work spans the entire state, and they are a trusted source for lifestyle tips, news, and educational information, AARP products, and certainly the AARP magazine. AARP is a great organization. They help people turn their goals and dreams into real possibilities. They strengthen communities and fight for the issues that matter most to families such as healthcare, employment security, and retirement planning. So I want to thank the AARP as a new member of the HR Power Hour sponsor family. So for more information about the AARP in Maine, go to www.aarp.org/ME.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. Our sponsors for today's show, AARP, taking on issues that matter. Northern Insurance Group, meeting your business, commercial, and personal insurance needs. And the law firm of Jackson Lewis, all we do is work. And today we're talking with Mark Ventola. He is a employment attorney at Sheehan Finney, Bass & Green in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome again. Thank you for being here. We've had a good half a show so far. We've talked about a lot of great wage and hour questions and gone through the definitions and talked about the challenges. Mark, let me bring up another one that comes up to mind all the time in terms of understanding and trying to understand how it should be paid and the ramifications from it. And this has to do with paid time off. Some employers offer vacation, sick, personal leave, all the different things lined up as individual items. Others say we're just going to group a huge block of time and call it a paid time off. Some of the challenges I hear about is in, for example, the state of Maine where we're based. You're required by law to pay vacation time. Not all states require that, but in Maine they do require vacation time, but you don't have to pay sick. You don't have to pay personal time if somebody should leave. But if you block it as PTO, then you have to do this whole definition thing of what each thing, you know, is and how it matters. Talk a little about how that all works together.
Yep, sure. PTO time has really become one of the trends on the part of employers because it seems, at least at first blush, to be administratively easier to just lump all the time together as opposed to tracking, as you say, the vacation days, the sick days, the personal days, the bereavement days, the, you know, you name it. There are a whole host of different reasons why folks could have a day off, with or without pay. When you lump it all together into PTO time, as you said, David, one of the challenges is the following. Many states require employers, when an employee leaves, is terminated, or quits, to pay out any accrued and unused vacation time. It sounds as if Maine is one of those. I've never really looked at the state of Maine, but it sounds from what you're saying.
It is, in fact, one of those. Yes, they do require that. That's correct.
Yeah. Yes. So you need, if you're going to put these all together, to, as David said, track your vacation time separately in one way or another. And if you don't, the risk is that, as an employer, you'll be paying out for all of those accrued and unused PTO days unless you're tracking them separately. So it's not always, for some reasons, PTO time is using it that way is great. For other reasons, it can be a real challenge, and it can mean that an employer is forced to pay out for more days than it otherwise would be on the termination of an employee.
Are there any specific rules in terms of accrual of time for this, or can an employer pretty much dictate, what they wish to pay when it comes to benefit time or bereavement time or sick time or any of the other times you want to call it out there. Are there any rules that apply or laws that apply that they have to provide certain things, or do they not even have to provide any if they don't want to?
While employees believe, and if, because it's very common in the workplace to have paid vacation days and paid sick days, most employees believe that these are a legal entitlement. In fact, they're a benefit, just like anything else. Employers are only required to pay for the days that an employee and for the time that an employee actually works. Employers are not required to pay for vacation time, or to pay for sick time, or to pay for bereavement days. It's just come to be accepted by many that these benefits will be given. Now, that said, there are a few states and a few cities where there is legislation either pending or that has been enacted to require a minimum number of paid sick days. New York City, for example, has gone down this road. And there's legislation pending in a number of states to make family and medical leave time paid as opposed to unpaid. Some employers choose to pay for family and medical leave time, but most do not. Most who are required, they meet the requirements of the Family and Medical Leave Act and are subject to it. They're not required to actually have paid time off.
Okay. So, I mean, that answers the question. I mean, that's my knowledge of it. Just making sure there aren't surprises out there. You know, it's important for people to understand that.
Yeah.
All right. You know, one of the things that we're seeing a lot of activity in, and I know you are as well, is that government agencies are really coming out and really being active on talking about wage and hour, and whether it be, you know, the feds or the state or the DOL, or, you know, if you're talking the NLRB, a lot of different places are out there really looking at this. It's a very active time today. Can you talk about that?
Sure. It really is. We've round about 2010, I'd say, we entered into a new period of government enforcement where a couple of things began to happen. One is that there was more funding given to both the Department of Labor, Federal Department of Labor, and the Internal Revenue Service to investigate claims, to investigate employers, particularly with respect to classification and misclassification issues. So the government has devoted resources to doing both random and targeted audits of particular industries where they believe that employers have a tendency to misclassify people who should be employees as independent contractors. One of the reasons why they've done that is that when employees are misclassified as independent contractors, the government loses tax revenue. And as you know, the government is looking for every possible means to increase the tax base that they have. So there's been resource devoted to that, and I've seen more random audits, I've seen more targeted audits over that period of time. In addition, the Department of Labor has implemented two or three different programs during 2010, 2011, 2012 to assist employees in understanding their rights and to actually connect employees with outside private attorneys in order to bring claims. Used to be if an employee made a claim to the Department of Labor, Department of Labor would investigate. Now, there's not as much of investigative resources for individual employee claims, so they refer them out to private lawyers to bring claims. So, again, it's one of the reasons why the risks are increasing for employers in terms of making sure you comply with wage and hour laws.
When you're looking at some of the challenges employers face in this high regulatory environment, what are some of the things that you would say are really solid, you know, tips that an employer can think about as how do I not get on that radar?
Sure. There are a few ways that, these things come up. And one of the one of the additional things I've seen in terms of government activity is that agencies cooperate now in a way they never used to. There are actually written agreements between the Department of Labor, the IRS, and state agencies that are similar, be it the State Department of Labor or the State Unemployment Office. And it's important for employers to be cautious in sort of the way they deal with these, not just the wage and hour, but really the classification issues, because they cut across so many aspects of what you do. For example, if you misclassify someone as an independent contractor, your workers' compensation insurer may pick up on that. And of course, if you've got 10 employees and 50 independent contractors, and you're only paying workers' comp insurance for 10 employees, your workers' comp carrier is going to look at that and say, wait a minute, we're running a risk. We're running a risk that one of those 50 independent contractors gets hurt, and we're on the hook for it. If that happens and your workers' comp carrier deals with it, odds are that other state agencies, the unemployment office, may want unemployment contributions for that person. So it's important to make sure, I think, that you're classifying folks properly. The other thing you need to do is make sure that your managers are trained in these areas and that they understand people do need to be paid for all the time they're working, whether you're asking them to work or not. This is something that often troubles employers. The law in this area is unique. The Fair Labor Standards Act says that an employer must pay an employee for any time that that employee is suffered or permitted to work. Suffered or permitted. Very odd language. But what it really means is if an employee shows up, is supposed to show up at 8 o'clock in the morning and start working, if they show up at 7:30 and start working, you have to pay them for that extra half hour, whether you ask them to be there or not. You deal with it in a different way. You deal with it on a discipline level. You deal with it on a training your manager's level. But you have to pay them. So it's important that your managers understand, at least in a very general way, the contours of wage and hour law and what is compensable, what is work time. So I'd say it's training is a very important aspect of this, David.
No question. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour, and we will be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
You might hear some advice from your friends on choosing a health plan.
Darling, you must choose the gold healthcare plan.
Not the silver plan. Too much trouble. Do they have a stainless steel plan?
I like bronze, like my tan.
Are sunburns covered? Instead, take advice from a licensed agent from Northern Insurance Group.
Meet face-to-face with a local healthcare exchange professional. Call Northern Insurance Group today. We have the resources to make sure you make the right choice.
We've all been there, at the end of the line, frightened, confused, crying out for the smallest human kindness, when finally there's a voice. Next! Most people would tell you that these visits to the Department of Motor Vehicles are the most hazardous times in a driver's life. But they're wrong. Dead wrong. Because the fact is, pollution caused by fuel exhaust is reaching dangerous levels. Right about now, you're probably wondering, what can I do? Plenty, my friend, plenty. Next time you're buying a car, choose one with the best gas mileage that meets your needs and fits your budget. Knowing that you're helping to keep our air cleaner and reducing our country's dependence on oil should slow your weeping the next time you're called in to renew your driver's license. For information on how to find a fuel-efficient car that's kinder to the planet and right for you, and for other easy tips on how to protect our world, log on to getgreen.com. It's easy to do, and you'll learn to save money on gas. Now, that's enough to make you smile.
Next!
If only for a moment. That's getgreen.com. A message from the Ad Council and Environmental Defense.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And we are back and we are talking with the infamous and famous Mark Ventola, now an HR Power Hour radio star from She and Finney Bass and Green. What do you think about that? That was pretty good, I thought, Mark.
Not bad.
Not bad.
I
okay.
I could have done better myself.
No, that's all right. Well, you know, we had another colleague of yours on from the firm. Obviously, Jim Reedy has been on, and he was a great guest as well. And so I'm sure you two will be comparing your radio debuts. I'm sure. I'm sure of it.
I'm positive.
No problem. All right. You know, we've been talking about the wage and hour issue and making sure that people are paid right and some of the rules and regulations that go about it, of course, some classifications, talked about some of the issues and concerns, the government oversight. How about you end the show here today with a great example of what can happen if you just don't do it right?
Okay, and I'll do that. And I, taking it back to what we had talked about earlier and describing wage and hour laws, sort of building the foundation of a house, if you don't get it right, things can happen later that really come home to roost. And an example that's happened to me and clients of mine over the last couple of years on several occasions goes like this. They have an employee, for example, in a retail establishment who's caught stealing merchandise from the store. Terminable offense. It's just not something you ever allow to happen. You can't allow to happen. And the person's fired right away. 10 years ago, that would have been the end of the story. But now, because people are more aware of their rights, that employee goes off and talks to an attorney. And 10 years ago, an attorney would have just said, typically, well, there's really not much to do. But now, an attorney will start to ask a whole host of questions about, well, you know, what's your age? What's your religion? You know, they'll try to figure out if maybe you were discriminated against. They'll then ask, how were you paid? You know, have you been paid for your overtime? And in at least two instances in the last couple of years in scenarios just like that where employees were caught stealing and were fired, I've had them turn around and bring wage and hour claims against my clients for not paying them properly. And you take a situation where it should be an open and shut case, end of the employee's employment, and yet because they weren't paid properly, they're going out the door with a claim. So it's a situation I don't ever want to see an employer be in. I'm sure no employer ever wants to be in that situation where they've sort of done it right from a discipline perspective, but they're undermined because the foundation of the house, the wage and hour compliance, was just not done properly. So it's something that, again, you just need as an employer to watch out for and make sure you're doing right.
No, I think this is such a critical part of building the foundation of any company, that employers really need to make sure they understand the rules, the regulations, the consistent pattern of what needs to be done. You can have every service in the world help you with this, but at the end of the day, you're still going to be held responsible for making sure people are paid properly. And so I think that this is such a critical topic. Tell me a little bit about how your firm helps organizations. Tell them why you think that they should call you. Gosh knows there's plenty of attorneys out there.
Yeah, sure. Well, we've got a very big employment practice, and I personally have spent a lot of my time on wage and hour law over the last 15 or 20 years. I got into it before it was such a hot-button issue, and for whatever reason, it's something I've always enjoyed. It is relatively quick and simple to sit with most employers and sort of run through their employment practices. You could call it an audit, if you like, a self-audit, and see if are you classifying your people properly. For someone who does this all the time like me, pretty quick to say yes or no. This person, yep, they're okay to be classified as exempt, or, well, let's red flag that one and look at it a little bit more closely. And then to run through a series of questions about, you know, things like, do you pay for training time? Do you pay for travel time? Do you provide the meal breaks you're supposed to? What do you do about people who are on call? Are those people you should or should not be paying? It's something that I enjoy doing, and it is really a relatively quick and painless and inexpensive process to try to make sure that you as an employer are in compliance with the wage and hour laws in particular.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you very much for being on the show today. I appreciate your insight and keen insight, I would say, on this matter. And I want to thank you so much.
You're welcome, David. I enjoyed being here.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour. If you're interested in hearing more about Mark or contacting him directly, go to hrpowerhour.com after the show. And his information will be there for you to click on, listen to the show excerpts, and, of course, contact him directly. And now the HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Northern Insurance Group. Licensed agents in 28 states, business, commercial, and personal. Go to northerninsurancegroup.com. Out of the category of HR strange but true, by the HRDailyAdvisor.blr.com website, comes a story about climbing trees on workers' comp as such not a great idea. A Texas man who reported he sustained a job-related injury while driving a truck and receiving income benefits from an insurance company was found driving a truck while collecting. Not a huge surprise. What was surprising was the fact that he also was found to be climbing trees as part of his side business. Texas Mutual Insurance uncovered evidence that the worker was currently self-employed in operating a tree-trimming business, as well as working for another company as a truck driver while receiving the income benefits due to his alleged disability. A Travis County, Texas district court has sentenced the San Antonio man to 2 years probation and over $7,000 in restitution. Texas law requires claimants to contract the workers' comp carrier when they return to work. So if you're on workers' comp and you think insurance companies don't know what's going on or that your employer isn't keeping an eye on you, please know that they are. And that's your HR Tip of the Week. Next week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to have two great guests. We're going to be speaking with Sean Gagnon. He is the manager of employee benefit practice over at Tour Ferris Insurance Group. We're going to be talking about the DOL audits. And we're going to be talking about a tool that can help you ensure that your compliance is up to date. And Sherry Welsh of Blue Sky Transformations. She's going to be talking about the core energy coaching approach to negative thoughts, draining emotions, and destructive actions and behaviors. We're going to be focusing on teams and individuals and making it work. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.